topics of great interest and the size of the audience this evening, I think indicates not only the interest in the topic, but the fact that Andrew Prentice, as a lively and entertaining lecturer, is also well known. This is, let me assure you, this is not our Monash series, science series, is not the Andrew Prentice show, because, but he is indeed the only person that's spoken twice in this series. And just a few weeks ago, Andrew and a group of other people from the Faculty of Science gave a symposium on life on Mars, and Andrew participated there. The majority of you will know that Andrew Prentice is a reader in mathematics, and he is really a very controversial person. He also has a soft spot in my heart, because what he's done is he's shown on a number of occasions that the American experts are wrong. One of the things he's done is he's come up, or he's developed a new idea on how the planets in the solar system were formed. And his view is that the normal traditional view that the planets were formed from a spinning mass of gases and they were formed at the same time simultaneously isn't correct, and he suggested that in fact there's another process going on, that in this spinning mass, as far as I understand it, Andrew, and please don't correct me if I'm wrong, that there are convection forces developed, and he calls these supersonic turbulences. And with this hypothesis with supersonic turbulences, he's actually made predictions about the actual composition of the planets and the moons of the planets, and also that hypothesis says that the planets were actually developed in a sequence, not simultaneously. Now, I think the interesting thing is that so far Andrew's predictions using this idea based on work by Pierre Laplace are correct. Now, that doesn't mean that Andrew's correct. It doesn't mean his ideas are correct. But in science, as you know, you can't prove something. You can only disprove it. Andrew is in the position right now where his ideas have not been proven, but his ideas have not yet been disproven. And I guess that's the best we can ever ask in science. This evening's talk is going to be called, it's not going to be called Project Galileo, it's going to be called The Galileo Mission to Jupiter. I have a great pleasure in introducing Andrew, and he assures me that this evening it will not go on for 2 hours as life on Mars was, but we will be finished in the normal sort of 60-minute range. Andrew, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Ron, for such a very warm introduction, and I hope I can live up to the task. Actually, what Professor Davies has said has really hit the nail right on the head regarding the scientific method. You really can't, you know, sort of bulldoggedly prove something, but in my case, sort of following a path where it's like playing Chinese checkers or something, I haven't as yet been sort of rolled out. And hopefully I can survive another, and certainly in regard to the Galileo mission, which has just started or about a quarter of the way through, it'll be interesting to see how long I manage to stay on the rink before the umpire blows the whistle. And so this evening, this is actually really intended as a public lecture, and it's wonderful to see so many, you know, widespread audience here and youngsters, and that's really what this whole series is about, to sort of show basically the wider community to give a glimpse of some of the things we're doing here at Monash. Now, I've for number about 20 years now been working on this sort of what I call the modern Laplacian theory of how the solar system formed, and This is it's currently being tested, as I mentioned, by the Galileo mission. If I use the microphone, in case you, that might be a little better. I think that projects my voice further. And also I can project the slide onwards with this device here. And it shows us the Galilean system. That was actually observed 17 years ago, thank you, Steve, by the Voyager. It's sort of like a family portrait. Just each individual picture of the Galilean moon has been assembled and put together there into a montage. And currently the Galileo spacecraft is actually orbiting amongst these moons. The spacecraft consists of two components, the orbiter, which is doing the orbiter, and we'll see a lot of that shortly. And there was also a probe, you might recall, that actually plunged into the atmosphere last December, and that told us a lot of information about the atmosphere of Jupiter and how closely or to what extent it resembled the sort of material of which the Sun is made. Because most scientists agree that somehow or other all of the planets from the solar system have formed from solar material. And so rather than somehow them all sort of coming together higgly-piggly from different parts of the universe. And it's really, we're just a little small island on our own when you consider the vast distance from Neptune's orbit. You have to go about 10,000 times that distance again before you get to another star. So for a Voyager, someone coming from outer space, you'd almost say, well, this is a sort of complete little system. Now, the Voyager, as I said, did its job 17 years ago, and it did establish that each of the satellite systems of Saturn in the foreground and Jupiter to the right, in fact, there's a pointer here, there's the Jovian system and here's the Saturnian system, in fact, really seem to be resemble miniature planetary systems. And my idea is, and I think probably most people go along with this, I'm not sure what's causing this sort of wind. There is a lot of wind at Jupiter, but I didn't think it would actually make its way down here. Must be something to do with this fellow. What might be my jacket? Electrostatic forces. I can always hold it like this. Will come to no harm. And so that was the upshot. We have, in fact, within our own solar system, at least two examples. In fact, I think something like, if you include the systems of Uranus and Neptune, something like four examples of miniature planetary systems. And the idea is that maybe all of these really form by the same mechanism. And the thesis that I've been advancing, in fact, it was a process of supersonic convection or turbulence, as Ron mentioned, within the clouds from which Jupiter, Saturn and Uranus formed. And the way these clouds shed their angular momentum and getting rid of their excess angular momentum and spin, they shed these gas rings from which these planets formed. Now, recent, as I mentioned, the Galileo 2 has just completed its second orbit of the of Ganymede. It's called Gany 2, and this is an image that just NASA has just put together over the last couple of weeks. What I thought I'd do as a little exciting thing would be to see if we can imagine that we are ourselves travelling in that system. So if all goes to plan, I'll press that button called Data, then come over to this screen, following Steve's very explicit instructions here, an S, an enter, and we should find ourselves at the Jet Propulsion Lab. This is an animation, but it shows the spacecraft centered on Ganymede in the middle, and Jupiter is sort of appears to be rolling past. In fact, it's just the orbit pursued by the spacecraft. The spacecraft is heading straight for the north polar region of Ganymede, and it's almost there. It's not going to collide, it looks like. It's just gone past it now, and then it's there, it's looking back on the night side of the planet. Now that actually, we can repeat that once more, but it's what is extraordinary is the way, oh, there's a moon moving across the left there. What is amazing the navigation, because the spacecraft came within 262 kilometres of the North Polar region, and it's something like a billion kilometres from here to the Jet Propulsion Lab. Now, we've actually seen that one, which is good. Type ESC, escape. And we can then try another bloke. S1, I think, which is to be recommended at this stage. very nice logo. And
This is the second flypast that occurred just earlier this month. It more or less shows the passage of the space. Here, it just actually shows the Galileo, and you can see how it rolls and tumbles, and that's why that sort of you get all these odd apparent motions. We might sort of just repeat that, and it's amazing what the sort of computer technology can do. The white sort of line through the middle is more or less the shows the mid-plane of the Jovian system. Now that's going to happen. That sort of process is actually going to happen about another 10 times with the different moons. And actually, we can have a look at the orbits if you're actually interested in orbital studying orbits, particularly green orbits, I think. That this is shown here in this one. It's the third of these animations that were just released. It actually shows the spacecraft. It goes out a huge distance from Jupiter. The orbits of the four Galilean moons are shown in the inner four circles, and you can see the spacecraft going around on it. And that was the second of the main orbits. The third orbit will be taking place in November, when the spacecraft goes past Callisto. But the navigation is extraordinary, how close they can come to there. So I thought that would just give you an idea of what's sort of going on there. When you hear about this Galileo orbiter, it's actually sort of yo-yoing around this Galilean system and making these very close passes. And during these close passes, the spacecraft can get amazing imagery of what's on the surface. We'll see a little bit of that shortly. And there are also various experiments on board the Galileo to measure things like the magnetic field environment. Are there any charged particles there? And in my case, the spacecraft becomes so close to the satellite, it's actually able to measure the sort of gravitational structure. And this provides a marvellous test for some of the compositional models that I've been working on. Each of the four moons have their own story to tell. The least evolved of the moons is actually Callisto, the outermost. And that one's probably hardly changed since the time it formed. But we know that Io, the innermost one, is very active. There are volcanoes that were observed. And just recently, on the first flypast of Ganymede, the Galileo discovered a magnetic field around the Ganymede, the second one in. So something seems to be happening in that moon. One suggestion, it may have a watery ocean or sort of with salts in it. But my suggestion is perhaps that deep inside there's a shell of magnetized magnetite, and which is a natural mineral which you can actually magnetize. And that would have happened early on in its history. And then, of course, there's the sort of Europa, which is a sort of very unusual moon, which some people claim may, in fact, have a mantle, actually may have a liquid ocean around it. Well, let's if I go back to the slides now, and that was a sort of view of them. Just the history of the Galileo project. It was a long series of delays caused by the Challenger disaster in January 86, over 10 years ago. That led to a number of delays before this mission was to have been launched later that year in 86. It got delayed because of that. It wasn't until October of 89, that's 7 years, almost 7 years ago, that it finally lifted off aboard the shuttle. It wasn't able to enjoy a sort of a Titan launch, which would have taken it directly towards Jupiter. So that was another delay. They had to design an orbital path that would take it to Jupiter without that extra energy. And so they got it off the shuttle bay, and then the thing had its own jets to get the additional energy required to leave the Earth's surface. Right at the top there, you can see the antenna in its furled state. And rather unfortunately, it did sort of stay in that, more or less in that state. It didn't unfurl, and that proved to be one of the most difficult engineering problems for the mission, was how, in fact, to recover the data. I'm just wondering, Steve, if you're in the back, is that the best focus we can do, or is it a slight, it could be a little bit of, oh, marvellous. You can never be sure whether there's atmospheric aberration, because that's things like that, but in fact, Steve has done a mid-course correction. Magnificent. A quality performance there. And I should add that these talks, although I'm the mug who's giving it, they could never take place without the assistance of people like Steve and another Steve Morton, and of course many other people in the maths building who've been very helpful as well, and Dr. Bruin in particular. So it's really a team effort. And so that's the story. And this, anyway, the Galileo finally got aloft, and it's there's a picture of the spacecraft showing its antenna. It had unfurled what it would look like, a huge beach umbrella. In actual fact, they've had to rely on the sort of low-gain antenna, which is actually this little guy here, a tiny little fellow back there. I think it's that one. And it's really made the job quite difficult. There's the probe itself. That was the one that landed in Jupiter's atmosphere. It sort of has a heat shield that goes around it. And that's all finished now. That thing weighed several hundred kilograms and went plunging into Jupiter's atmosphere. It's all sort of melted now and destroyed. This is the path I mentioned following the launch in 89. It went in towards Venus and then out through the Earth and made several little skips past the inner planets, each time picking up a little bit of extra velocity through a process known as gravity assist. It actually went past a couple of asteroids, Gaspra, and there's another one called Ida over there. On the inner path of Venus, of course, you don't see anything. It's shrouded with sort of sulfury gases, and it's very hot down there. Of course, it came back past the Earth, and an interesting view here of the Moon in the foreground, moving from left to right in its orbit. So that's the Earth-Moon system, which is quite unique. And so there was a lot of interesting science en route, including, as I mentioned last time, the discovery of a little moon called Dactyl. It's only about a kilometre across, and just going around this giant moon called Ida. And so there were a lot of interesting science. That's one of the asteroids, a stony sort of object. And last December, that big day arrived when the orbiter and its probe, which had actually been released back in July of last year because it had to pursue a slightly different trajectory, that went into the atmosphere and the orbiter went past. And that's when all the excitement occurred. And this is sort of an artist's idea of what it would have looked like. See the sun in the distance. There's the orbiter staying in orbit about Jupiter. Here's the probe sort of descending into the atmosphere of Jupiter. And it was thought there might be a lot of lightning and things like that. And in actual fact, there's an awful lot of discoveries were made about the structure of the atmosphere. We can mention those. This was the actual entry point somewhere just north of the equator. The thing came roaring in at a huge speed, 106,000 kilometres per hour. There was a very narrow tolerance of entry angles. If it came in it was too shallow, it would have just skipped right out of the Jovian atmosphere, and if it came in too deep, it would have just started tumbling. And the heat shield is only on the front, and it would have actually around, I think, not sure about that. It looks like it's already done a flip. But the idea was it would certainly be destroyed. So it was it's a magnificent engineering feat. It more or less landed on target. And as they discovered, it actually landed near what's a sort of a hot spot. And initially that was thought to be the reason why they didn't find much water. It was thought perhaps that's a region where it's a bit warmer than normal and there's not much out in a desert region. And therefore there wasn't much natural water around, but they're not really certain about that one. In any event, the probe only barely scratched the surface of Jupiter. Jupiter's an enormous planet. It's got a diameter of 70,000 kilometres, 10 times larger than the Earth. The Earth's only about 6,000 kilometres, only about a twelfth, in fact, of that size. The probe really only just really went into the surface, and it was thought the surface was layered like a cake. Turned out the Jupiter is much hotter than was previously thought, and the whole thing is mixed up, and there isn't any layering. This is another artist's impression of the probe going in, and this is the sort of path it would have pursued. It, of course, had a parachute to slow it down, of course. And then it lasted something like about just on an hour, I believe it was something like 58 minutes, and got down to about the 20 bar level, which is equivalent to several hundred metres of depth in the ocean. So it really covered quite a lot of interesting region with respect to chemistry, and so a lot of the main objectives of the mission were met. met. It would have been nice if it had lasted a bit longer, but no one knew the atmosphere was so hot, so the thing prematurely burnt out. It was thought there were these three big layers of sulfur crystals, water, ammonia crystals, sulfur crystals, and water clouds, but that wasn't really found. The whole thing seemed to be pretty jumbled up, and yes, there you go. That shows the sort of going into the atmosphere, very little pressure at the top. One bar is the sort of pressure we enjoy in the Earth's atmosphere, and then 20 bars, as it's got here, be several hundred metres of ocean water. And the temperature changed very dramatically from minus, well, unfortunately this is in Fahrenheit, that's about 103 or minus 170 Celsius up to plus about the same point. It was expected that they'd see all these clouds, but as you can see, that was the expected situation. Turned out that possibly because of the hot region it landed in, there seemed to be very little clouds, measured by a thing called a nephthalometer, measures clouds. And also there were various measurements of winds, and it was found there were very strong currents, wind currents in Jupiter's atmosphere. It's believed that these currents are actually caused by a huge amount of heat being generated within the interior of the planet. Jupiter gives off roughly twice the amount of heat it receives from the Sun, and this causes the atmosphere to become very turbulent. I'm not sure how many of you do any sort of hang gliding. I certainly don't do any, but I know up near Benalla there's a normal sort of gliders, and over the summer the gliding communities, a very harmless sport, do rely on thermals and updrafts. Well, it would certainly be quite a field trip to do this at Jupiter. You certainly get more than you bargain for. Huge speeds, you know, hundreds of kilometres per hour. That was the main discovery. There was a lot of interest in lightning. It turned out there was about 10 times less lightning than was expected, and this is because there's almost 10 times less water than expected. You do need the water vapour to make conditions right for lightning. So that seemed to hold together. And the thing that I was really interested in was the atmospheric composition. They had a special machine, a thing called a mass spectrometer, that would measure the relative abundances of all the materials. The most predominant material is hydrogen. It makes up about something like 90% of Jupiter's atmosphere, and or 85% thereabouts. And then you have other materials. Helium is the next most abundant material. These were all measured. These aren't the measurements. This was just the capability of the machine. Some people believed that helium is actually, in the conditions inside Jupiter, would actually be immiscible with respect to hydrogen, and it wouldn't dissolve with hydrogen. It may actually get helium droplets, and it was possible that the atmosphere of Jupiter might actually be depleted because of this sort of fallout. It turns out that there was a little bit of fallout, but not terribly much. The relative abundance of helium was found to be close to that of the Sun. It is possible, because of all this convection and so on, this helium, even if it did form droplets, would be swept up again, and that probably kept it fairly uniform. It was also initially felt, back in January, that the composition was very similar to the Sun. It turned out that picture changed by about May, but one thing that didn't change was the water abundance stayed very low. Jupiter's atmosphere was exceptionally dry, and that still seems to be the case, and that's still a puzzle. Though actually I did publish a paper a few months earlier predicting that Jupiter's atmosphere would be water deficient by at least 50%, and that does seem to hold up. Like most theories, after that paper was published and before the probe arrived, I sort of decided to see perhaps it wasn't quite as dry, because I was looking at the moons of Jupiter, and moons like Europa and Ganymede and Callisto, they're called the icy Galilean satellites. They would need a certain amount of water to produce that ice, and it would be a bit of a disaster to have a tenfold deficiency of water vapour in the primitive cloud from which the moons form, because the moons would all be rocky, which isn't true. What is true is that the moons of Jupiter do seem to be deficient in water by about a factor of about 60 or 70%. They don't have as much water in them as they should relative to what are called solar abundances. And in fact, I had published a paper about the same time pointing out one could modestly expect a sort of a 60% reduction. And I think that's the one that probably will hold up in the long run. There is the final results were produced in put together in Science magazine. And the really important thing that came out of that mission, from my viewpoint, the diagnostic of the heavy element fraction within the Jovian cloud, it turned out that the measured value was something like 77 parts per million, or 7.7. And in my paper, I had predicted that Jupiter's rock fraction, the rock fraction would be enhanced by a factor of about 2. Instead of finding a solar value of about 3.7 by 10 to the minus 5, I was predicting a value of 7.4, and that was produced before the probe result. And you can see, in fact, it is within the error bound. And that in fact, was a major achievement for my model. The water should be deficient relative to rocks in order to account for the Jovian moons, but the measured value of water is still much less than I had. So that's still a puzzle, not just for me, but for others as well. That was the probe. Now, after the probe had done its job, the Galileo orbiter was inserted into orbit around Jupiter. It had to lose a bit of energy to do that, and there was a sort of for about a period of over an hour, there were retrograde rockets were put on to slow it down, and finally the orbiter was ensnared by Jupiter and really became an extra new satellite of Jupiter. It then began its task of exploring these Galilean moons with all those series of orbits that we showed earlier. And this part of the work bears directly on my ideas of how the solar system formed, because for a long time now, ever since I did my PhD in Oxford with Tahar, we wrote several papers together suggesting that the Galilean system of moons, of which you can see here Io and Europa and down there Ganymede, really do bear many close resemblances to the Sun's own planetary system. One of the most interesting things is not only do they all orbit around the planet in the same direction like the planets around the Sun, but there's a remarkable chemical gradation as you move outward through that system. The inner two moons are mostly rocky, like the inner terrestrial planets, and the outer moons have got increasing proportions of ice. Callisto isn't shown there. That, in fact, that's so far out, I believe it has a lot of ammonia ice. It formed at even lower temperatures. But these moons are very small compared to the primary, that is Jupiter. They're each larger than... in fact, Io is about 10% larger in size than our moon, and Europa is about 10% smaller. But Ganymede is the largest natural satellite in the solar system. It's something like 50% larger in size, or even larger than that, than our moon. Here's another close-up. Now, these are Voyager photographs, and eventually the Galileo will produce its own images. But, of course, you've seen those. But it just shows how Jupiter, even its red spot, which is something like 20,000 kilometres across, that you could fit three Earths across there, it's absolutely huge. And as I said, Io is larger than our moon. It really dwarfs these satellites. And now, here's an interesting picture that Ian Sullivan of the ASV produced. It shows the planet Mercury moving in transit across the Sun, just to show that just as the Jovian moons are dwarfed by Jupiter, in the same way the Sun is very much larger than the planets. So there's another feature which Tahar and I worked on, is to try and to explain. And in the end, we came to the conclusion you needed a new sort of force in the cloud from which the planets formed, and this was a force called supersonic turbulence. And we stumbled on this over 20 years ago and have been actually sort of trying to promote this idea. But the supersonic turbulence does allow the planet or the sun to throw off a series of gas rings which have very small mass compared to the Sun. And that's the secret as to why the planets are so small compared to the Sun, because they condensed from very little gas. And the Sun was effectively able to, and I've got a movie of this we can look at shortly, show how it got rid of its angular momentum that way. I mentioned the very close similarity between the Galilean system and the planetary system. Here are those four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and the densities decline monotonically, or they decrease uniformly. Little Mercury is the densest, then Venus and Earth and Mars. Actually, that's not quite true. The Earth is a little denser than Venus, but the Earth has a reason for that, because it did in fact hatch the Moon, and I believe the Moon formed from the outer mantle of the Earth in the Earth's infancy when it was very hot, and the Earth lost a lot of its outer low density mantle, and that's why the residual material is a little denser than Venus. But that's another story. But this is another NASA picture, a montage of all the different shots showing how big each planet is drawn to scale there. And but the similarity is there, and that the conclusion is that the satellite systems and the planetary systems have probably formed by the same mechanism. Now, what was that mechanism, and why do they all pursue their own orbits? Well, this was first put forward, as Professor Davies mentioned at the start of the talk, was by Laplace. And this year is 1796, in fact marks exactly the 200th year since the publication of Laplace's theory so-called nebular hypothesis, whereby it was suggested that the primitive solar cloud in its infancy was once a huge cloud of gas contracting out of the interstellar medium and spinning slowly, and as it grew smaller in size proceeded to spin up because it was conserving angular momentum, and eventually Laplace envisaged a ring of gas was left behind at its equator. This is a pretty rough old diagram, but you go down this way and then down this, and anyway, Laplace conjectured you'd have this family of gas rings which were left behind by the retreating primitive cloud, and then the planets would then condense later on. He didn't show how they'd condense from these gas rings, but at least it did explain the common motions. And that's the basis of this model that I've been working on for the last 20 years. Now, that's actually a portrait of Laplace there. And he did his work not just entirely on his own. That's impossible to do that. And he relied, the theory depended very heavily on all the discoveries that had been made prior to his time by Copernicus and Kepler and of course Galileo, after whom this mission is observed. Galileo was the very first person to observe the moons of Jupiter in 1610, and that got him into a lot of trouble with the church at the time, because it was believed that, you know, the Earth was the centre of the universe and everything went around the Earth. And here was Jupiter out there with sort of four or five moons all going around Jupiter. So this sort of contravened the existing sort of Ptolemaic view, I think it is, or Earth-centered view of the universe. And of course in more recent times, certainly in case of Einstein, but Newton's law of gravity was absolutely crucial to the development of the hypothesis. And that's how science progresses, not only as by the method that Ron mentioned through proving and disproving things, but also you have to build upon the work that's been done before by others, and you can save a lot of time that way. Because I'm constantly keep telling the undergraduates, you know, so you can't just constantly sort of reinvent the wheel. You do have to go along with what's been done, and so that's marvellous. It does explain those common motions. It doesn't explain why the Sun shed a discrete family of gas rings, and the distances between the planets are actually much larger than this. Pluto also is in an inclined orbit, but at least it goes around in the same directions as the others. It's possible that Pluto is actually a secondary, an escaped object that formed on the same orbit as Neptune. Neptune takes 165 years to complete an orbit, and while it was getting together, there could have been one or two little runaways who were trying to form their own planets around on the other side of the orbit. And it's quite possible that Pluto and Charon were actually cousins that formed on the same orbit. And in fact, it's now been discovered that there are many other little sort of objects like Pluto lying outside the orbit of Pluto. Just over the last two or three years, the Hubble telescope and other telescopes have discovered a whole swarm of little rocks out in the what's called the Kuiper Belt, There's an interesting article about this in the last May's issue of Scientific American, from which this diagram was somewhat largely drawn. What it shows is that Neptune after it forms, these little guys, in fact Triton was probably captured by Neptune, but even the other planets flicked these out. But let me say that there's not enough material out there to form another planet. A lot of them are in the same orbit as Pluto. Their distance, what's called their semi-major axis, is identical to that of Pluto. And then there's another cluster that has somehow got themselves locked into a sort of resonance out there as well. The whole mass of all these little guys put together is probably a 10,000th the mass of Neptune, and they're just little strays that are left over. So we don't get to get too alarmed. And really, Neptune does mark the end of the line. It's a sort of the Pachyderm of the Dandenong line. That's when even zone 3 ends there. Now, so that really is a very sharp boundary at the edge there. But what was this process that caused the Sun to throw off these gas rings? Well, I think it's a process which is seen in the galaxy and other stars that are forming. It's a phenomenon of supersonic turbulence. There are very young stars called T Tauri stars that have very active surfaces and evidence of sort of convective currents and violent outbursts, many times the speed of sound. And I conjectured in 1973 that these convective outbursts, like a rapidly boiling kettle, would produce an additional pressure inside the cloud. And I called this supersonic or turbulent pressure. And this is actually an equation, but it shows here that the total pressure in the cloud, you need to put this one into the computer, but it's the normal gas pressure which we have in any gas like this room, and plus an additional pressure due to all these jostling currents of gas that are rising and falling, and they create an additional stress. And I actually, from the work that was studied these T Tauri stars, the data of a chap called George Herbig, it was clear from George's data that these turbulent velocities were supersonic by a factor of 10, and that caused the pressure to go up by a factor of 100. And it's this extra pressure, which you can't really see today. Today, if you look at the Sun, there's a lot of magnetic forces, but there's very little convective pressure that's left. But in the early days, when the Sun was drawing together out of the interstellar medium, all the huge amount of gravity that would have had to been released would have caused this convection. And this is, I believe, is the reason that the Sun shed these gas rings. Probably have to show a seminar to actually prove that, but it is this phenomenon of supersonic turbulence, and it causes these rings to be shed.